This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
It's boxing.
A look inside boxing with Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Interviews, analysis, and everything going on in boxing. And now a man who I wish was called the Boston Bleeder.
All doctors to the ER.
It's sort of like getting punched in the face.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back, SI Boxing Podcast. On this episode, we're going to dive deep into the Canelo Alvarez lawsuit against Golden Boy and DAZN. Canelo, the biggest star in boxing, he is looking to get out of his contract with his promoter, get out of his contract with the network he signed with just back 2 years ago, and become a free agent. Michael McCann, the legal analyst for Sportico, he joins me to break down this from all angles and maybe project out a little bit what the future and the outcome of this lawsuit is for Canelo Alvarez. A little bit later on, Sergio Mora, the former junior middleweight champion, my broadcast partner over at DAZN, he joins me to talk about Canelo. We get into the back and forth between Devin Haney and Gary Russell. Teofimo Lopez, he has signed his fight to face Lomachenko. How is that going to play out? That and much more with Sergio Mora. As always, best way to support this podcast, get over to Apple Podcasts, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, on to my conversation with Michael McCann. All right, let's jump right in. Michael McCann is here, my former colleague over at Sports Illustrated, now a legal analyst and senior sports legal reporter over at Sportico. He's also as good as it gets at explaining complicated lawsuits to simpletons like me. Mike, thanks for joining me, man.
Hey, you got it, Chris, and you're no simpleton. I can assure you of that.
Well, when it comes to reading long complaints, I certainly get a little glassy-eyed throughout all of it, so I'm hoping you can boil this down for me a little bit. So just to set the table, on Tuesday, a lawyer for Canelo Alvarez filed a 24-page complaint in federal court over in Los Angeles. Alvarez's lawsuit includes accusations of breach of contract, intentional interference with a contract, negligent interference with a contract, fraud, and breach of fiduciary duty. He is seeking at least $280 million in damages, which would effectively be what is left of the 11-fight contract he signed with DAZN in 2018. He's also asking to be free of any contractual obligations with his promoter, Golden Boy, and with DAZN. In a statement, Canelo said, "I am the pound-for-pound number one in the world. I'm not scared of any opponent in the ring, and I'm not going to let the failures of my broadcaster or promoters keep me out of the ring. I filed the lawsuit so I can get back to boxing and give my fans the show that they deserve." So, Mike, I guess we'll start here. Just kind of your 10,000-foot view of this lawsuit, your sort of immediate takeaways from reading this and digesting it.
Sure. So one important thing that I think has to be emphasized is we have not seen the actual contract, that this is a breach of contract lawsuit. The contract itself is not publicly available. It wasn't included as an exhibit in the complaint. So that's sort of, you know, the big piece of information that will likely instruct how successful this lawsuit is missing from our ability to assess what's going on. So with that caveat, when I look at this lawsuit, it is certainly symbolic of the times we're in, where this is a professional athlete who believes that he is being deprived of opportunities to fight in ways that he contends would be safe. That's not unique to him. Of course, other athletes have raised that point. And then on the other side, there's a broadcaster and a promoter that seem to hold different views about what they're obligated to do under the contract. And there's disagreement about how to proceed with fights where there wouldn't be live audiences, revenues would have to be restructured. There's a lot of uncertainty. So this is obviously a story that has a history to it, but the contemporary part of it to me is pretty revealing, that this is occurring during the pandemic where there's disagreement about what is contractually required, and there are definitely defenses that will be raised against these claims.
Yeah, with reference to the contracts, there are multiple contracts at play here. Canelo has one contract with Golden Boy. Golden Boy has one contract with DAZN. So we're talking about two unique contracts that are in place here. I mean, with litigation like this, Mike, will the contracts have to be exposed? Will there have to be transparency here in this process?
Yeah, they'll have to be exposed, though whether the public gets to see them is a separate consideration. So at some point, the contracts have to be part of the litigation, because clearly the court can't proceed in assessing whose side is correct if the court can't see the actual contract. And as you mentioned, there are multiple contracts. And who knows what emails have been sent and other messages that might have a bearing on those contracts. So absolutely, Chris, the contracts have to become part of the litigation, but they could be filed under seal. The parties might seek to keep the contracts out of public viewing. Certainly, the media would be interested in looking at these contracts, not only for this case, but just in general, given the sort of historical magnitude of a $365 million deal. The contract itself would be newsworthy. So they will have to be part of the litigation unless they reach a settlement. Whether we get to see them is a separate consideration.
Are you able to, you know, in your position as an experienced legal analyst, are you able to assess the strength of this lawsuit at all without seeing the contracts? Or, I mean, I guess the question is there any way to sort of ascertain how strong Canelo's case is without knowing what's in those contracts?
It's definitely difficult to sort of project the likelihood of success without actually being able to see the contracts. What we can do in lieu of that is look at the legal arguments, how they're crafted, and project the likely defenses. And here the defenses could include force majeure. There might be language in the contract that provides a way out of paying him, given the pandemic that we're in. It's also possible there could be clauses in the contract that require arbitration before they can go to court. It's also not clear that California is the right forum for this case. Sometimes contracts contain forum selection clauses. So, and even beyond that, there are other arguments that could be raised. There's impossibility, there's impracticability. So you're right, Chris, it's very hard to assess the likelihood of success without seeing the specific contracts. And also, in fairness to the defendants, to look to see what their arguments are, because when they answer the complaint, they're going to say all sorts of things that aren't included in the complaint. They're likely going to portray Alvarez as breaching the contract somehow, that he has not lived up to the terms of it, or that he's misportraying what's in the contract.
When you read that complaint and look at the charges that kind of Alvarez is assessing to DAZN and to Golden Boy, do any of them stick out to you specifically? Did any of it raise kind of your eyebrows as more interesting than others?
I think they're all related to the contracts. It's a sort of breach argument that he is in the right, that he's been unlawfully denied opportunities to fight and to be paid. What to me will be interesting to see is how the arguments related to interference, specifically interference with prospective economic relations, that he is being deprived of chances to monetize his value. And if it's true, as the complaint suggests, that there were discussions about, I think, having a fight on the top of a skyscraper and other things. One is that's just interesting to see that they were trying to be creative and coming up with alternatives to how to have a bout in the absence of a live audience and in a bubble environment. To me, that's going to be interesting to see how flexible each side was. And I think that goes to the interference arguments that, you know, is he really being denied a chance? And he, of course, as you mentioned, seeks a court order that would allow him to negotiate with others. I think that relates to that as well.
Yeah, I do, you know, from my own reporting, I know that they were looking at unique venues or opportunities during this pandemic, whether it was a skyscraper or, and I had heard on Alcatraz, you know, whether it's fighting on an aircraft carrier in the San Diego area. I mean, they were looking at all sorts of different things. So they definitely were trying to think outside the box over the last couple of months. I'm interested in your view, though, Mike, of the eighth count, that fraud concealment, where it seems to argue that Canelo was intentionally misled on the terms of the Golden Boy's deal with DAZN, especially when it comes down to Canelo Golovkin. I mean, this really is what this boils down to for a lot of people involved. It seems like, you can tell me if I'm wrong, it seems like this lawsuit is contending that Golden Boy didn't disclose that they allegedly made promises to DAZN that weren't necessarily spelled out in Canelo's deal with Golden Boy. What did you make of the fraud part of all this?
Yeah, so fraud is a hard argument to make in a case. It's just the standards for establishing fraud, especially here where there are sophisticated business actors. Alvarez obviously has an agent, multiple representatives. So for him to argue that he was misled, the counter argument is going to be, well, what were your advisors doing? Were they asking the right questions? There was an awareness that there were other contracts and other business relationships going on that impacted his deal. So were his own people doing the right due diligence? That could come up as well. So perhaps he was misled. I just think he is not sort of a consumer in a store, right? I mean, this is someone that's pretty sophisticated as a business actor. If he was misled, what were his agents doing? You know, why didn't they pick up on potential discrepancies and why didn't they demand disclosure? And it's possible that Golden Boy is going to say, look, we told them everything. You know, we have done everything we can. We've shared everything we need to do. We've adhered to the contract. We weren't expected to provide more information. We answered all questions. I mean, there's a lot of ways in which this can turn.
If Golden Boy either implied or outright has in the contract that with DAZN that Canelo will fight Gennady Golovkin, and if they don't have that in the contract that they have with Canelo, I mean, how does that resolve itself? I mean, if let's just assume that as the hypothetical, right? That in the contract with DAZN, Golden Boy promises in some way, shape, or form to deliver Canelo Golovkin. In the contract with Canelo, it doesn't spell that out. I mean, how does that resolve itself legally?
To me, Canelo is in the right. If that hypothetical is what the facts are, DAZN and Golden Boy should sue each other over that. And Canelo wouldn't be obligated to do something that isn't in his contract. If there's no actual requirement in any contract that he signed that he has to do a certain thing, and DAZN and Golden Boy are disagreeing about whether he has to, in a way, it's not really up to him because he isn't obligated to do something unless he's really obligated to do it. And I would hope that DAZN and Golden Boy aren't sort of making promises to each other that are really in that context about a third party, Canelo, because they need to get him to agree to do something contractually before he's obligated to do it.
As you look at this, as you sort of digest this situation, Mike, I mean, how unusual is it from your perspective to see multiple contracts, one between fighter and promoter, another between promoter and network, where this possibility even exists that there could be conflicting language between all three parties?
Yeah, I think this is pretty unique. And part of it, of course, reflects the sport that boxing structured differently, especially at that level, where the promoter and the broadcaster are integral. And they really do their own contracting. As you know, in the NBA, we wouldn't see this issue with a player, right?
Right.
So the fact that this isn't a team-based sport, the fact that there's no collective bargaining agreement, the fact that there's no media agreement between the union and the league, you know, the fact pattern here, I mean, it's structured so differently from a team-based sport. And of course, the fact that he's the best or one of the best around puts him in a position where he's going to sign multiple contracts.
In the hypothetical we were discussing, if, you know, like DAZN's perspective, from what I understand, is that they have approval rights over Canelo opponents. It doesn't seem like, from reading that lawsuit, that Canelo believes that. I mean, this seems like, once again, we're in an area of discrepancy between what Golden Boy negotiated with DAZN and then what Golden Boy turned around and negotiated with Canelo. I mean, is this a big problem for Golden Boy in this? If they're writing one contract one way and another one another, I mean, is that as And legally, is that problematic for them? Or is this just a case where DAZN should have done their homework more and, you know, basically had it spelled out that this fight would happen at X date?
Well, I think in that scenario, DAZN, you know, it's sort of one of these situations where Alvarez is the third party, right? He is the party that's not part of a contractual agreement over who decides when and where he's going to fight. To me, I have to think that there's more to the story than that, that maybe there are emails that are sent, because Alvarez and his representatives, I'm guessing, are aware of that potential discrepancy. And I would think that they would have tried to address it at some point. And maybe they did, but it's certainly a strange scenario where, unless he's obligated to do something, you know, it's hard to obligate him to do something, right? So, you know, two parties that are sort of talking about the third person, you got to bring the third person in there.
Yeah, and I thought it was very interesting that a spokesman for Golden Boy, Stefan Friedman, came out and said, effectively, no one ever promised Canelo versus Golovkin. That's a pretty strong statement. Like, when I read that, you know, better hope there's not emails or right. That there's not, you know, some kind of correspondence, right? Because if there are, even if it just hints that this is going to happen, that would be problematic for them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, unless the contract says in so many words, this is the term of our deal and we exclude all other communications, it might have that. Sometimes that's called a merger clause. Mm-hmm. In the absence of that, those emails could be pretty significant if they were sent. And this is why this case could turn a lot more interesting fast. Well, not super fast, but after there's an answer to the complaint, we'll see a motion to dismiss. And if it gets past that, then we're looking at discovery. And if we get into discovery, there will be emails, there will be text messages that could share a lot of light on what was said about his obligations. And it could put some people in a tough spot if they were making promises that they weren't authorized to make.
So just to put a button on the fraud part of all this, you look at that, and I'm just recalling what you just said there, you look at that as being difficult to prove. Is that fair to say that that's a challenge to prove?
I think it's a challenge if the relationship is entirely contractual. If there are other pieces to the story with emails or text or other documents, other correspondences, it gets a little fuzzier. It's hard in a case like this because we haven't seen the evidence. We haven't even seen the contracts. So it's always difficult to project, but in general, that's a hard claim to bring.
I can say, without any evidence, I can say I just don't believe people in boxing are smart enough not to have text messages and emails. I don't believe it. I think there's got to be some stuff flying around there that sheds more light on this situation, what was promised to who and when. When you read the damages part of this, the $280 million, which, like I said, is basically the rest of his contract, and, you know, being free from DAZN and from Golden Boy, what was your reaction to that? I mean, is that... that's a sizable amount of money to ask for, you know, effectively not earning it, not going out and getting that money. What was your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, they're the lawyers. They're going to ask for the moon, and they're going to try to get it. I think it would be probably difficult to establish that level of numbers, and it's also predicated on a lost apparel, lost endorsements. There's a lot to it. If it ever got to the stage where that number became examined in a trial, there would be expert witnesses that would appear that would try to assess how accurate that is. It's certainly a huge number. And as you know, if he can go out and do other fights, he would sort of cover a lot of that expense with new fights that would take the place of those that he would have fought under the contract. So it's a huge number. On some level at this point, it's sort of it's not necessarily that relevant because we're so far away in the litigation before that became a key factor. It does, however, and I think this is where it might matter, that may be their asking price for a settlement, right? That, and I assume at the end of the day, this case probably settles. It's a complex contractual arrangement where it's really at the end of the day about money, and the parties could get together and work out a solution. Now, they haven't yet. but they could. And that's where that number becomes more meaningful, because it suggests what his asking price is.
So let's talk about a potential settlement for a second, because, and this is where I'm going to sound really stupid. My understanding is that absent a lawsuit, DAZN can't negotiate directly with Canelo. They negotiate with Golden Boy, who negotiates with Canelo. It's why there are two contracts to begin with. With Canelo suing DAZN, does that allow them to negotiate with Canelo directly now? I mean, does it take, and I'll throw a phrase out there that I've heard, but I'm not sure, maybe you can articulate better, but the idea of tortious interference, like, does that take that off the table?
It could, although in reality, once there's a demand letter sent, normally the parties can begin to negotiate, because this lawsuit wasn't the filing of the complaint wasn't the first step. I mean, it's the first step that we saw, but prior to this, there would have been a demand letter sent by Alvarez's attorneys to DAZN and to Golden Boy, maybe others for all we know. And the letter would have said, we have these grievances, we're going to file a lawsuit, let's talk. So they probably have already had some degree of communication, unless the party said, we're not going to settle this, which is a possibility too. So they could have likely negotiated at that point, but certainly once the case is filed, they can negotiate in a more direct way, though I think they could have done that before as well.
Okay. Last question for you. You know, I think people in boxing that are familiar with boxing lawsuits remember, like, Mikey Garcia. It was probably 6-7 years ago now, where he was trying to get out of his contract with Top Rank. It was a protracted legal battle that cost Mikey Garcia years off his career. If this plays out in court, and I'm actually with you, Mike, I think a settlement is the more likely outcome with all this, but if there isn't a settlement and this becomes a legal battle, how protracted could it be? I mean, how in California, how long does stuff like this, or in federal court, I guess, how long does it play out?
It could be a while. I mean, it's a federal case. Federal cases tend to take longer. It's also a federal case. It's a civil case in the middle of a pandemic, and a number of hearings have been pushed back because of the pandemic, where courts are really trying to marshal their resources in a way that focuses on criminal matters, because of obviously they're more important because somebody could go to prison. So there's certainly the possibility this could last months. It's also potentially years, because we're talking about litigants that are wealthy and they have the money to hire lawyers that could litigate for a while. That could lead to an appeal. If this ever got to an actual jury trial and a decision, there could then be an appeal. I mean, this is, again, it's too early to tell, but if we play it out in a way that involves everyone sort of gearing up for a long battle, this could be a multi-year battle. Is that likely? No, but it could.
Yeah, we are literally talking about millionaires and billionaires, so there is money behind the lawyers involved in all this. I think everybody in boxing hopes it doesn't last that long. And I don't think, and you can see it from Canelo's statement, like, I don't believe he wants this to drag out. I think he wants to get back in the ring, right, and is looking for the right opportunity to do it this way. But, I mean, is that, like, just to finish off, I mean, seeing those not us seeing those contracts, but a judge or whomever seeing those contracts, that's probably going to illuminate a lot of things quickly, right? Like, I think we'll have some answers once somebody sees, and who would see those contracts? Would it be a judge first? Like, who would see those contracts that could be able to look at these things through?
So the judge would see the contracts, and they would be part of a future pleading. Whether we the public get to see them would hinge on whether or not they're filed under seal and whether the judge allows them to be filed under seal. But certainly the court would see them. And throughout the process, the court will likely urge them to have settlement talks, because the judge will say, at the end of the day, you're arguing about money. There's probably some sort of fix that makes everyone more or less okay with the outcome. But whether the judge opines on which side has a stronger argument, some judges are more direct about that than others, but the lawyers might get a sense of that if they have a hearing in court or on Zoom, I guess nowadays we'd say on Zoom, because the judge might signal which way he or she is leaning.
When you When you see that lawsuit, does it sound to you like Canelo's looking to get his hands on all the, like, are they trying to get all the paperwork for themselves? Is that part of all this?
Possibly, although I would have to think that they have some of these documents, but it could be one motivation that they want to get more information. I do think it's just about, like you said, he wants to fight. Mm-hmm. He feels like he's losing money. He's frustrated with the fact that he has to now go through two different entities whose interests are not necessarily perfectly aligned. And he wants to get back out there, and he probably views a lawsuit as the best way to do it. I mean, yeah, I can't get inside his head, but I'm sure his lawyers have told him this will probably end in a settlement, and we're interested in getting you back into the ring as soon as possible.
Yeah, I think if nothing else, it breaks a logjam, or at least it kind of just shoves things in one direction, and hopefully it leads to a settlement. I'm part of the masses that want to see Canelo back in the ring as soon as possible as well. Michael, I always appreciate your time, man. Check out Mike's piece on this topic over at Sportico. It's a great look at how this could all shake out. And always feel smarter talking to you, Mike. Appreciate you you doing this.
Anytime, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Coming up next, the former junior middleweight champion, Sergio Mora. All right, Sergio Mora is here, the Latin Snake, the former junior middleweight champion, my broadcast partner on DAZN. You can also check us out twice weekly on DAZN, Jabs with Mannix and Mora, which comes out Tuesdays and Fridays. I am off this week, which I know must make Sergio so sad, so very, very sad. Am I right, Sergio? You're depressed by my absence?
It was the two best episodes of Jabs I think we had all year. Me and the wonderful Todd Grisham had a great time on the show. His cup is always half full, unlike yours, that's always half empty.
I try to keep it real, Sergio. I try to be as honest with my audience as possible. So, you know, I can't be just bright-eyed and optimistic like you at all times.
Please don't ever say the word keeping it real ever again.
Okay. All right, Sergio, I want to jump in with this Canelo Alvarez situation. And we don't have to get too deep into the weeds on it. Earlier in the show, I talked to Michael McCann, who's a legal analyst, about the lawsuit itself. But as a fighter, I want to get your take on this. I mean, you know, you've broadcast Canelo's last three fights. You know what it feels like to, you know, kind of be looking around, wondering why a deal can't get done to have a fight get made. What was your reaction to seeing this lawsuit filed by Canelo Alvarez?
Ah, man, it was painful because we all wanted that fight to happen in September. You know, May and September are huge holidays for not only boxing, but especially Mexican boxers and Mexican independents and Cinco de Mayo. Those are the two biggest dates. So when there's no boxing on those two dates, especially when there's a quarantine and a pandemic going on, it just feels like a miserable year piling on each other. So it's just, you know, business and boxing and, you know, it's show business, man. There's a show and then there's a business. And when those conflict, then we get what we're getting. When you have Canelo, the pound for pound number one fighter in the world, promised a certain amount of money, but then there's a pandemic that hits, then everyone's pockets gets hit. There's no fans in the stands, so there's no way for promoters to make money, no merchandise to sell. It's just horrible, man. So no one knows how to react to this certain situation. So I'm sure there was a miscommunication between Canelo, his promoter, and Golden Boy, and then Golden Boy with the deal they had with DAZN. So it's just a tragedy. It's happening, but it's a miscommunication on everyone's part.
Yeah, and let me get your take on this because you're right. The pandemic has changed things. If we were not in the middle of this pandemic, we would have had Golovkin fight Kamaru Usman last spring. We would have had Canelo against Billy Joe Saunders. And if they came out of that, we would have been, you and I, preparing to call Canelo versus Golovkin 3. I mean, that was pretty much set in stone. But, you know, part of the problem has been the pandemic, but you know, part of it now is that we haven't seen Canelo Golovkin 3 yet. And last fall, Canelo could have accepted a third fight with Golovkin. You remember those negotiations. I mean, you know, everything fell apart over the summer. Canelo lost his Mexican Independence Day date. He had to fight Sergey Kovalev in November. And Canelo's refusal to fight Gennady Golovkin for personal reasons, I think that's contributed to all this. I mean, it all kind of traces back to that for me, Sergio, that Canelo, you know, because he doesn't like Gennady Golovkin and he doesn't like some of the things Golovkin said to him and about him, specifically when it came to the positive drug test, that he didn't want to fight him last September. And I think when we kind of look back at the story of this mess, that's part of it. I mean, I think Canelo has some, I don't want to say responsibility, but I think that contributed to where we are right now, that Canelo wouldn't fight Golovkin last September.
Yeah, it's a prideful thing. And not for nothing, you know, not only are these two, you know, stubborn champions and, you know, they're men and they're aggressive, they get the testosterone going. Forget all that. Now we're talking about they're both businessmen making tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. So they're businessmen now. And then when the money gets involved with their natural pride of being a fighter, then it's more than just two fighters and bad blood. Then it's, you know, lawyers. Then it's the business and contracts and you know, those funny Latin words that are in contracts that I'm sure no fighter understands, but they can get translated in many different ways. So that's when the problem starts, when the suits start becoming involved, because, you know, it's not the suits going into the ring, it's the fighters. And once the fighters and the suits mix up, it just becomes a headache, man, when you get the two biggest stars in boxing that when they were hungry, before the money hit, before everyone, you know, that big influx of money came in, they were just two fighters at the top of their game, and they wanted to prove to each other who's number one. That's it. The first time, no one really found out. A lot of people thought Golovkin won. Bad taste in the mouth, rematch, nothing really got cleared there either. So we wanted that trilogy to happen, and that's the reason these guys got that big money. It wasn't for Zurameta, and it wasn't for Rocky Fielding. It wasn't for fights like that. It was premier fights, and that's where this entire problem comes up. So whatever the Latin word for premier is in that contract, that's where everyone's, you know, getting confused in the miscommunication there. So it just sucks for the fighters, man, because once the money gets involved, once the business and the suits get involved, then the passion, the purity of what made these guys champions goes out the window.
Yeah, I understand Canelo wanted to get his money. He's got a contract, and you should expect the person that gives you the contract to live up to it. I just think that when you look back at all this, I mean, him deciding not to face Golovkin will loom large in all this. And hopefully it all gets ironed out. I think it's still possible that we see Canelo back in the ring at some point in November, Golovkin soon thereafter, and they're both on track to fight in that Cinco de Mayo weekend in May of 2021. I hope that's how this all plays out, because I think they both need that third fight now to get some momentum back on their respective careers. All right, let's talk about something.
Hold on, Chris. Before, let me ask you a tough question now. Is Callum Smith a premier opponent to you? Is BJ Saunders a premier opponent to you?
Yes, I think they are elite fighters. I just think you have to basically put it your thumbprint in blood that no matter what's happening next year, if this pandemic is still going on, if it's clear, whatever, you have to fight Golovkin. Like, I don't believe that DAZN has a problem with Callum Smith or Billy Joe Saunders. They just need that damn fight to happen. I mean, Sergio, the fight has already been devalued to a certain degree. I mean, Golovkin, after he beat Steve Rolls, you could say Golovkin, all right, he's back, still the top of his game type of guy. But after having that kind of life and death fight with Derevyanchenko, he's diminished a little bit. Now, maybe he gets some of that back against Zurameta, which I think he will, and that builds the momentum back up. But you've got to have Canelo saying, and Golden Boy saying, no matter what, May 2021, if this pandemic is still raging and you lose the gate, we don't care. You've got to do that fight before Golovkin hits 40. I mean, that's just what it is. Canelo and Golovkin are signed to DAZN to fight each other. Simple as that. Whether they signed, whether they said it specifically or not, that's why they're with DAZN. That fight needs to be on the books one way or the other for anything else to happen.
I agree. Okay, I don't agree with you much, but yes, I agree that Callum Smith and BJ Saunders are premier opponents. They're undefeated champions. How can they not be considered premier? I agree with you there, but I think DAZN and Golden Boy or the contract or the Latin word for premier, they were expecting the trilogy, of course, or maybe even something, you know, a cross promotion fight, a UFC fighter, just like Conor McGregor did with Floyd Mayweather. They consider that premier, but to a boxing fan, we don't want, that's not premier to us. Charlo is premier. Golovkin is premier. And if you're a hardcore fan, then you think about Callum Smith and BJ Saunders. But we're on the same page on this one. So, yeah, I'm with you, Mannix.
All right, let's move on to what we saw this past weekend. Jermell Herring, 130-pound champion. He defended his title. Wins ugly. Jonathan Oquendo hit Herring with the headbutt the middle rounds. Herring decided after the eighth round that he could not continue. Herring took some criticism immediately. Tim Bradley, the former junior welterweight champion, had some words about Herring kind of giving up there. And on social media afterwards, because social media sucks and that's what happens there. He took some heat and he clearly took a lot of that heat personally. Your reaction to not only Herring deciding not to continue, but the criticism of Herring after the fact?
I understand the criticism, and that, you know, part of being a boxer, part of being an athlete is accepting the criticism, because the fans have a say. They pay to watch you perform, and if you're not performing to that level, they have an absolute right to do that. And now with so many social media outlets, of course, it's going to be more direct to the actual athlete, and it's going to sting a little bit more, and it's going to last a little longer. But I didn't think he quit. And that's a harsh word, man. I really hate the word quit. And I don't like it when it's thrown around so easily, just like the word great. I don't think, you know, boxers should be called great or athletes should be called great unless they really deserved it. If that they're on that elite great level, there's so many different words and synonyms for great. Use that one and use another word for quit. So as far as Herring goes, I don't think he quit. He found a way out, but that's not quitting. He retreated. That's not quitting. Herring is a soldier. He's a two-time Iraq veteran. You know, he's a Marine. There's no quitting in Marines, but there's retreating. That's part of a strategy in battle. If you're outnumbered, if you're not you know, fighting at your best, you retreat, you regroup, and you fight again. That's what rounds are for. You know, first round ends, you go to your corner, you get that minute to actually rest up and to, you were retreating in a way. You're catching your breath to go out there and fight again. I don't think Herring quit. If he wanted to quit, he would have quit in the fifth round. He would have said, oh, I can't see, this is it. And he would have looked for that way out. But he continued another three rounds. It's the blood getting in the way of the vision. That it's not that it hurts. It's not that he can't see. You can see when you're cut. It's just the mix of Vaseline and blood makes it harder to see. It looks like you're looking underwater. You can fight through that, and that's what Tim Bradley and Andre Ward and even myself on social media were criticizing, because we've all been cut. We've all had to face that adversity. We know that every fighter, 99.9% of fighters, had to face an adversity through cuts, and you fight through it. But when you're doing it on that elite level, especially when it's televised, and you have a way out, a loophole like I called it, you're going to take it, because you have a bigger fight looming against Carl Frampton, a bigger fight, more money, and that's the fight that he wanted to salvage, and he wanted to get out of this one that he was winning. He was winning that fight handily, and I thought he was winning unanimously. So that was his way out. But quitting, that's way too harsh.
And that's the thing, too. I don't believe that Oquendo was going to beat him. Like, he had some moments there, but I don't, like, it would have ended in a lopsided decision in favor of Jermell Herring anyway. So regardless of the outcome, he was going to win one way or the other. It doesn't change how, you know, what the fight was going to play out as. And you're right. I mean, we're all looking ahead to Herring versus Frampton at some point in the fall. You don't want to see Herring get even more hurt. And look, Oquendo was flying that head around all over the place. Is a chance he could have opened that cut even more. And then maybe we're talking about surgery and, you know, things like that to deal with it. I don't have any problem with Jermell Herring. And people that think Jermell Herring quit, I mean, give me a break. I mean, the guy is as tough as they come. He didn't quit. You can say he, you know, he could have pushed back harder when his corner was, you know, willing to let him stop. But it ultimately doesn't matter. I mean, The outcome was predetermined. It was done. Oquendo wasn't on his level. He went down in the early rounds. Herring would have won that fight going away. So let's not call him a quitter, and let's all move on to Herring versus Frampton, which I think is a very good fight between two top level 130s, and we'll go from there. I didn't need to see Herring have that cut become even worse. And I understand Tim Bradley has been through wars. You've been through some tough fights. You always want to see guys tough it out, but let's keep it in perspective here. All right, he was badly cut. He was in a fight that he was winning handily. It was ruled an intentional headbutt that caused the cut. So, end of story for me. I don't really have a big problem with the outcome of that fight.
I'm not accustomed to agreeing with you two questions back to back. That's weird to me.
But there okay. You go. Let me turn to this for a second here, Sergio, because this came up this week as we saw Yordanis Ugas win a world title at 147 pounds. Now, this is the WBA's version of the world title, which is among the more stupid of the world championship fights. And Ugas is a very good fighter. I like Ugas a lot. But afterwards, he's talking about being a world champion now. This is just like 3 weeks removed, Sergio, from Jamal James winning the interim version of the exact same world championship at 147 pounds. Both those fights televised by Fox. The actual world champion for the WBA is Errol Spence. He has that title. Oh, I'm sorry. It's Manny Pacquiao. He has that title, you know, because he won that fight against Keith Thurman last year. Errol Spence is the other two pieces of the title. Sergio, you're a fighter. Why do fighters even bother? Like, you have to pay a sanctioning fee, right, for these titles? I know you fought for a real one, the WBC belt, at 154 pounds. But help me understand why fighters even bother with this. These aren't real titles. They're real titles. There's one per division, and there's one per organization. Like, I don't get why anyone would pay a nickel to the WBA for the right to have a world title that isn't the real belt. Why do they do it?
Because we're kids and we all like shiny things. That's exactly why. We want to feel rewarded, like a feeling of accomplishment. And the real reason why, in all seriousness, Mannix, this is why. Because growing up as a young amateur, you're accustomed to seeing Sugar Ray Leonard and Roberto Duran, and I'm speaking on my behalf, Marvin Hagler, Donald Curry, and, you know, so many great champions, Benitez, and then you reach the heavyweights. We're used to seeing those belts on television. We're used to seeing Mike Tyson hold up the WBC and the WBA, the IBF, and all these other belts you're talking about. But there's so many belts now in the four-belt era, and then you have these interim championships, then you get this franchise champion, then you get the diamond belt, and then you get the super belt and the super-duper belt. I mean, it's ridiculous. It really is ridiculous. It really waters down what it means to be a champion. And I love the fact that, you know, fighters start speaking out of that. Championship, you know, level fighters like Errol Spence, you know, he tweeted something like, "Damn, man, how many champions are there?" And he's absolutely right, because we don't even know who the champion is anymore. Back in the day, we knew who the champion was. We knew the heavyweight champion was, the welterweight champion. And that's not the case anymore, because there's four champions in every weight division. And then those four have branches of interim champions. And it gets to be ridiculous when no one knows who the F is a champion. So that's the frustration. That's where this comes up. Remember what I used to call those interim belts? Remember that word I used and you liked it?
Which one? Hubcap?
That's right. That's what my trainer used to call them, hubcap titles, because they're a hubcap.
They're stupid. They're just so stupid. Like, it doesn't diminish Ugas as a fighter. He's an excellent fighter. It doesn't diminish Jamal James as an up and coming guy. He's an excellent fighter. But it just confuses people, and they're not real. Like, they're not worth the medal that's on the belt. And I think it's important for us as broadcasters and for media members in general to point this out, to just shame people into not using these belts and calling them real championships. It's just not fair. Like, you're trying to draw in casual fans, and it gets harder to do that when you can't explain who the hell is the world champion of what. When you're talking about, we've got three world champions in one weight division with one organization, it's hard enough to explain the four organizations set up in boxing. It gets even harder when one organization gives out three titles. So the whole thing is just, it's just wild, man. I just wish I wish fighters wouldn't do it. I understand your point's well taken about you grow up wanting to have a belt around your waist. I just wish more fighters would tell these organizations to piss off and say, you know, keep your crappy belt. I'm going to just keep fighting until I get a real one.
Shame the fighters, man. What got into you, Mannix? I think that the 3 months in that quarantine, that NBA bubble, really made you even darker somehow. Shame the fighters into it.
It's not just shaming the fighters. It's shaming promoters. It's shaming broadcast. It's shaming everybody involved. Just don't you know, empower these sanctioning bodies to be able to say it's a world championship fight. They're not world championship fights. It's nonsense.
Shame them. Whole thing. Okay. Hashtag be best, Mannix. Be best.
Be best. Get a real fight. All right. A couple other things I want to hit you with. Devin Haney's out there on social media right now hinting at a possible fight against Gary Russell Jr. Now, Gary Russell, as we know, 126-pound champion. Haney fights at 135. Russell's been making some noise lately about moving up in weight. He publicly challenged Terrence Crawford. That didn't really go anywhere because it was kind of nonsensical. Now you have Devin Haney at 135 pounds saying that there are negotiations between himself and Russell for a fight at that weight class. Sergio Russell is an incredibly talented guy, doesn't fight all that often, is known for fighting basically once a year, often against a low-level opponent that serves as his mandatory, but I mean, what do you think? Do you want to see Gary Russell against Devin Haney at some point this year?
Yeah, of course. Gary Russell's a name. He's a U.S. Olympian. He's the longest reigning champion. I mean, yes, he's one of the most inactive fighters. I believe he's only fought one time the last 4 or 5 years, which is ridiculous. But he's still Gary Russell Jr. He's still a name. He's still the best name that Devin Haney's going to have on his resume. And I mean, I really got to credit Devin Haney for demanding that fight. It's not really that he threw his name out there. He's actually baiting him into that fight, this young champion. So it'll be the youngest champion in boxing in Haney versus the longest reigning champion, experienced fighter in Russell. I mean, yeah, this is exactly what boxing's about. And if they're willing
Let me ask this, sir. You've seen Russell. Like, the idea of Russell fighting Terrence Crawford was stupid. That's too big a jump for a guy to make. Gary Russell, 126-pounder, jumping up to 135. How big is that? Too much of a jump for him to take? Because we've seen, like, Lomachenko at 126 and 130 is unbeatable. And we'll talk about this in a second. But Lomachenko at 135 is not the same fighter. I mean, how is that too much weight for Gary Russell to jump up to go to 135?
Yes.
You think so?
No, I know so. It'll be. He's jumping up 2 weight classes, and I crunched the numbers here. He's going to be 4 inches shorter, 11 years older. I'm talking about Russell, and there's a 7-inch reach disadvantage on Russell. So yes, that's huge. That's something that's unrare, and it's something that, you know, it's like Roberto Duran jumping up 2 weight classes to fight Sugar Ray Leonard. Yes, he beat him, but I mean, it was. It's just way too much, man. That's way too much size advantage. I think the reason that Russell's doing it is because he sees that Devin Haney is a young, ambitious, you know, maybe wet behind the ears a little bit. And I think that's where Russell thinks he has advantage in the experience and that pedigree. And he might see holes. But the size alone, if you just break down the numbers, that's just way too much size advantage on Haney's part. But you got to love the fact that Russell wants that fight.
I don't see it happening because it's not like Russell's asking for a ton of money, at least not according to Haney. Like, $1.5 million is not a huge number for a fight of that caliber. And I've got to believe that Al Haymon will find a way to keep Gary on that side of the street. I mean, there are enough fights for Gary Russell to participate in on the PBC side. I mean, it is kind of astonishing, Sergio, that we haven't seen Gary Russell against Leo Santa Cruz. I know Leo Santa Cruz is set to fight Gervonta Davis, but why those two haven't fought yet is a little mystifying. You could make Gary Russell against Gervonta Davis if Davis beats Santa Cruz in his fight against December. I have a hard time seeing PBC allow Russell to go over to the matchroom side where he could get beat up. I mean, I think Gary's a tremendously talented guy, but I think Devin Haney is an elite skills guy, and because it's his natural weight class, I think he might beat up on Gary Russell. That Russell's fast, and maybe he can outbox Devin Haney, but I just don't see PBC giving him that opportunity. I think they'll find a fight for him at that price point that'll keep him there. I hope I'm wrong because I want to see that fight. I certainly want to see it more than Devin Haney versus Yuri Gamboa, but I just get the feeling that somehow in the next couple of weeks, something will pop up for Gary Russell that'll allow him to stay on Fox and Showtime and PBC, and we won't see it happen.
Whatever the case is, I just hope Russell fights more than once a year because he is an excellent talent, and he has the fastest hands in boxing. I can go on record to say this. I think he has the fastest hands in boxing. I used to think Amir Khan had the fastest hands, but now that Amir Khan's a little older, Gary Russell still has the fastest hands, and he's fun to watch.
No, he's really fun to watch. I hope, whether it's Devin Haney or somebody else, I just want to see him in a big fight. He hasn't been in a big fight in a long time, and that's how you measure yourself. That's how you test your skills against those top level guys. All right, let me finish with this. We know we've got a big fight coming in about a month or so from now. The 135 pound unification fight between Vasily Lomachenko and Teofimo Lopez. That fight's going to take place on ESPN, which is great news because it's not going to be on pay per view. It's not going to be on any kind of premium service. You're going to be able to watch that on basic cable, and that's going to be a huge fight. I mean, Lomachenko goes in, Sergio, as a pretty strong favorite in that fight, but Lopez is more than a live dog here. I mean, Lopez is coming off that win over Richard Comey. He's able to make 135 more comfortably now because of the different people that he's working with. Lomachenko's a pound-for-pound great, maybe the number one pound-for-pound guy in boxing. How much of a chance do you give Teofimo Lopez, and how does he win a fight against Vasily Lomachenko?
Man, you always have to give a young, hungry, ambitious, a fighter champion now in Lopez an opportunity and a chance to do it. But it just, he's going to be biting off too much than he can chew, because in order to beat Lomachenko, you got to do two things. You got to be an excellent, boxer, and you got to have excellent brawling ability, because you have to brawl him early and box him late. You have to make Lomachenko come towards you, use his feet, and then you have to back him up later into the fight, or vice versa, however you decide to do it. You have to do a little bit of both. You can't just go in there thinking you're going to outbox a pound-for-pound number one fighter in the world, or think you're going to outslug him, which we've seen him get grimy and dirty with fighters like Orlando Salido, but he's grown a lot since then. So it takes timing, which I think Lopez is excellent at, power, which he definitely has. It's the experience of having to go from boxer to brawler, win rounds, be smart about winning rounds, swallow your pride and not mix it up with them. Even when you think you're winning that round, that's when you put it in reverse and let Lomachenko come towards you. It's going to take a lot, man. It's going to take a lot of experience. And that's where Lomachenko, I think he towers over him in experience. But timing and mixing up your attack is how you beat Lomachenko.
I think you've got to be physical with him because, as I mentioned, he's not a big 135-pounder. He is a good-size 130, maybe a big 126, but he is not a big 135-pounder. And Lopez is a big 135-pounder. And I think you've got to – look, if Lomachenko –
Maddox, hold on. Let me stop you there, Maddox. You know how incredibly hard it is to be physical with a fighter, a southpaw that switches and is always fighting you from angles? It is the hardest thing to do. It's impossible. He's like a Rubik's Cube. You can't get physical on him. The way you get physical on Lomachenko is when he's aggressive towards you. Believe it or not, man, it's the hardest thing to try to track down the Matrix, man, someone like that. High Tech, that's his nickname. But he is like,
well, that's kind of my point, though. Like, you, Lomachenko's coming towards you. Like, he's all offense. He's a good defensive fighter because of his skills, but he's all offense all the time. Like, he's going to throw punches at all different angles. You've got to counter those punches with big shots of your own. I don't think Teofimo can beat Lomachenko by decision. I do think he can stop him because we've seen Lomachenko go down against Jorge Linares. He went down. I think Lopez has the power, more power than a Jorge Linares, and I think he's got an opportunity to land some big shots. I think he's got to land something huge against Lomachenko and either stop him with one punch or force kind of a stoppage with a flurry. I think if it's just a boxing match, he'll lose 118, 110. I don't think he's on the same level as Lomachenko boxing-wise, but I do think his power is there, and I think when Lomachenko comes forward, Lopez's got to throw back. You've almost got to make it a straight-up brawl and try to win it that way.
You're not going to land that power without timing. So like I said, In order for Lopez to beat Lomachenko, it's going to be timing first and mixing up boxing with brawling. Power and the speed aren't going to be enough here because Lomachenko has way too much pedigree and experience to let, you know, fast hands or big power, you know, be effective. Timing, Mannix, that's going to be key.
No, I agree. I agree. It'd be a good fight. Looking forward to that sometime next month. Sergio, enjoy your next show with Todd Grisham. I'll be back middle of next week. I'm going back on vacation now because the NBA bubble has broken me, and I'm going to go back to bed.
Vacation, Mannix, please. This is the first time I see your bare arms. You're wearing a cutoff sleeve shirt. I never want to see you wearing a cutoff sleeve shirt again. And next time I see you on your vacation, hopefully you get a tan because you're as pale as they come.
I'm going to go sit by the beach and just soak in that vitamin D for the next few days. But I will see you on Jabs on DAZN next week. Check that out. Subscribe over at DAZN. Good to talk to you, Sergio.
I wish I could say the same. Say love you.
All right, that's it for this week's episode. My thanks to my guests. As always, subscribe to the podcast over at Apple Podcasts. Rate, review. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.